to order.
Nice pattern on your tie.
Really, bill on the calendar today is Senate Bill 5, Medicaid for Certain Disabled Children. We have the prime sponsor with us, and Senator Ellis, I would invite you to make any introductory comments you wish, and then we'll go to public testimony.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate you having this bill before the committee. There's something wrong with a system that pays for institutional care but won't help a family that wants to care for its loved one at home. And this bill, which has come to be known by many of the parents and advocates for Medicaid waivers and options as the Brianna Hurley bill. She's a little girl who's now 2 years old. She was born with cerebral palsy, and her parents have tried very hard to keep her at home and not institutionalize her, keep the family together. Unfortunately, it's broken up a marriage and financially devastated this family. The fact that the government, the federal and state government, will pay to institutionalize a child to the tune of over $100,000 a year, but has been unwilling or unable to provide support in the home to keep the family together. So Project Choice offers us a great deal of hope with Medicaid, a change in the Medicaid law, and there are monies in the budget to achieve that that change. And so the state is moving forward. This bill is sort of a backup or safety net, you can think of it in those terms, to take care of those kids that don't need all the services that a waiver would provide that we're applying for under Project Choice. Because a waiver is not, that may not take care of all the folks in the state of Alaska that need it to make this cost-effective kind of choice. Options, and while waivers offer more services, they're limited in the number of people who can receive them. And it remains to be seen whether everyone will be served through, all these families will be served through Project Choice. We can help people's lives and positively impact the budget, in my opinion, by having options kick in after the department has experience with the Medicaid waivers for those families that aren't able to be served by waivers. Because options offer fewer services, but everyone can qualify. Everyone who's categorically eligible can qualify for an option. And not everybody needs all the services provided under waivers. It's a pretty extensive list of services. And so this allows the state to have more flexibility and sort of a safety net if everyone is not who needs it and is cost-effectively served, their needs aren't met by a waiver. So I've worked with the department on this. I think we've come up with a good compromise to for this to kick in after they've got the waivers up and running. And if it isn't necessary to kick in, then we won't have expended any of the money or effort on this. But it seems like a good thing to have in place, because there is a very strong concern across the state that not everyone will be served with waivers, and that not every family is appropriately served by waivers. That in fact some people would be overserved, and that could be not the right approach for every family with a child that experiences some sort of disability. So with that, Mr. Chairman, there are lots of details involved here, and I know there are folks from the department, and I would be happy to respond to questions now or after the public testimony.
If anyone wants to ask a question now, I'd entertain it, but I'd probably rather go to the public testimony, and I have some questions, but I'll hold it until after the testimony. Senator Lehman, have a question?
No.
On teleconference, first I'd like to call on Brenda Trumbull in Kloak.
Thank you. Can you hear me all right?
We can hear you. Please proceed.
Can you hear me?
We can hear you. Go ahead.
She's not hearing you.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead, Brenda. We can hear you.
Okay, thank you. My name is Brenda Trumbull. I'm living in Kloak down in Prince of Wales Island. I testified on this bill in the past. I think it's important to point out that last year this bill made it through the whole committee structure, but did not have time to come for a floor vote last year. I have two sons. I have a son 15, and I have a little boy, Logan, who's 11 years old, who has cerebral palsy as a result of a DPT immunization at 5 weeks old. He is developmentally disabled, but we have been very fortunate to receive the family support, such as respite, care, personal care attendance that we have needed, and we feel pretty good that he has a full, meaningful life in the community and in his school. I'd like to tell you today about what happened to the rest of our family. 3 years ago, my husband Larry left employment of 14 years and started his own business called Wood Marine. He markets thick as spruce for musical instruments, violins, cellos, basses, mandolins, around the was we had sold Blue Cross long before this child, this disabled, was born. But when my husband changed employment, we lost our health insurance on the child with disabilities after paying the COBRA option for 18 months. So what happened to obtain Medicaid coverage for him was that we had to totally divest ourselves of all our resources and begin to live below the poverty level, severely limiting our business opportunities, obviously. Alaska is the only state left that still has a situation going on for families. We had to get rid of our life insurance. We are in our 40s. We can have nothing for retirement. We can't even have a burial plot. Our oldest son is very bright. He wants to go to Oregon State. We can't have any resources in the bank to save for
bright.
Him.
That's my own.
We're currently trying to maintain health insurance for the rest of our family, which costs $478 per month, and it's going up all the time. So we're wondering if pretty soon we're going to have to drop that and all go on welfare. We certainly qualify. The only option, the only way out of this for us is to put our child in foster care or institutionalize him, but this goes against everything I believe in and that I worked for over the past few years. So passage of this bill would let us once again pay our own way and contribute to society. We really don't want to have to choose between losing our child or our livelihood. And if this bill passed, it would guarantee that no Alaskan family would ever have to fall as far as we have. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Are there any questions of committee members? If not, thank you very much. I think you can stay on line to listen, even though you're not on the at a teleconference. So she's called me. Okay. Next in Anchorage, Laurel Putnam, please. We can hear you. Go ahead, please.
My name is Laurel Jane Putnam, and I am the mother of four children, and I'm married. Our fourth child was born 2 years ago. His name is Reed David Putnam. He had complications right at birth, so he was stillborn, and it took him approximately 17 minutes to resuscitate him. Due to brain damage, he suffers from cerebral palsy, a seizure disorder, and profound mental retardation. Prior to the birth of our son, my husband was employed, and we had an insurance policy at that time. With the economy going the way it was, he was laid off from that job, and so we were able to hold our COBRA plan for 18 months. Because our child has a pre-existing condition, he is not able to. My husband in the interim did get another place of employment, and he did get some insurance there, but because of the pre-existing condition, Reed is not able to be insured under that policy. So what we've had to do in the last, since December when we no longer had insurance, is we've had to place our child in foster home. As a family that made the decision to have our child come home with us from the hospital and not be institutionalized, it was a very difficult decision and one that we do not appreciate in the least bit, that we find ourselves having to either give up our child for the betterment of the other three children at home or to place the other three children in poverty status. We're both, my husband and I are professional individuals. I'm a film hygienist, he's a civil engineer. We found it very disheartening to find that we had a state here that did not have medical waivers or options in place. I'm also a member of the Project Choice Steering Committee, and I'm also a member of Alaska COPE, and so I am very familiar with this issue. I am concerned that we do need to have the safety net that Senator Ellis did speak about for those children that come after the birth of our child and the children that are going to be born in the next few years. There needs to be something there for them. I also feel that it's important that we be sure to have a program that is adequate for the child. A waiver will be great for some children, but I believe that the Breonna Birdie bill will actually be better and more cost-effective for other children. I think that it's really important that you realize there are a number of families that are in this situation, and due to technology, there will be more families in this situation in the future, as these children are able to be treated medically and cared for. I find if we had placed him in Our Lady of Compassion, it would cost $7,000 a month. Last year, he was fairly healthy, and he was able to avoid hospitalization, and the whole bill at home came to under $60,000 a year. So it's much more cost-effective to have them in our home being cared for than to have them in an institution where room and board alone would be, what is that, $72,000, $74,000 a year, let alone his treatment and his medication in addition to that. I think that if you have any questions that you'd like to ask me, feel free to do so. It's really important that we realize these children do better within the walls of their home with their families that love them. And I hate to see family units destroyed and broken down into poverty because they choose to retain a child and keep that child in their home.
Okay, thank you very much. Are there questions for Mrs. Putnam? If not, next in Anchorage, Carol Libby, please.
Hello, I'm Carol Libby. Are you hearing me?
We hear you. Go ahead.
Yes, I am an educator, and I work in programs for infants and children here in Anchorage. I work with several families who have medically involved children, some of whom are served presently by Medicaid. And some of the families that I have are having to compromise quite severely their family economic situation to receive the Medicaid coverage. This can compound the issue of the medically fragile child by imposing limitations whereby the family is unable to get employment that would adequately support them and support other children in the family. The mental health in situations like this is often compromised. It's not unlikely to see a lot of depression in families where they feel such a limitation in what they're able to do if they provide what is needed for the medically fragile child. I would just urge your sincere support of the Breonna Hurley bill in separating the children and the family in the Medicaid situation so that the child will be independently receiving the services without having to compromise the family. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for Carol Libby? If not, next, Elaine Hurley.
Hello, I am Elaine Hurley, and this is Brianna's mom. For those of you who do not know, Brianna is 23 years old and has a terminal brain disease that is caused a severe amount of brain damage and disabilities, seizures, that kind of thing that goes on and on. Brianna needs 24-hour care. It is very complex at this time. Last year, I was lobbying pretty hard for this bill, and I also might make mention of the fact that last year, House Bill 438, the same bill in which we're looking at now, passed through the House and in both committees in the Senate, and just we just basically ran out of time before we got a vote. So last year we had a lot of support on this, and it passed everything. Just to remind you, legislators that are new this year, I have to say, I almost feel expressed out. I was there last year, and last week, and I can't say anything different except that how desperately that we need this to go through. As other people have mentioned, this is the last state. Alaska is it. We're the last state that doesn't offer either a waiver or an option. Last year, I was married, and my husband had a job. We ended up quitting to provide Brianna with Medicaid. You know, first we tried. It seems the families in this situation, first they try to quit their jobs and impoverish themselves, and then they go to other means. And I just like to bring the point that when a family is placed in this situation, and when they impoverish themselves, they are now on the poverty level, and they are eligible for a whole gamut of services, AFTC, housing, food stamps, on and on and on. And I know this is a finance committee, but to reiterate the fact that it is cost-effective to keep these children in their home and not break up families and not impoverish them. I just ask for your support on this bill, and hopefully we can get it through this year. Thank you.
Okay. Are there any committee questions? If not, is there anyone else on teleconference who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 5? Okay, is there anybody in the audience here who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 5? Not,
Mr. Chairman, Chris.
Oh, Chris, please. I'm sorry, I didn't see you raise your hand.
My name's Christine Culleton. Hi. My name's Christine Culleton. I live here in Juneau and have a daughter, Courtney, who's 8 years old, who is also one of the medically complex children that we're discussing today. My daughter was forced into institutionalized care and an out-of-state placement because the state of Alaska could not meet her needs with Medicaid. Our insurance and our income were too high to access the Medicaid system, and we were not willing to impoverish our entire family in order to meet her needs. Currently, Courtney lives in a foster care placement here in Juneau because she was deinstitutionalized under OBRA 89. The state of Alaska had a very difficult time finding a foster placement for this child. In fact, searched for over a year to find a family that was willing to help provide the additional support that we would have readily given her ourselves had we been able to access Medicaid for her. Options and waivers are in dire straits for this state. We have families, as you've heard, who are forced into poverty or to giving up their children. This doesn't meet the needs of anyone in this state. It costs our state much more money to provide all of the additional services or to find out-of-state placements or institutionalized placements than it does to provide these families with basic Medicaid services. The families that I deal with here in the state primarily do not place their children in foster care, but in fact impoverish the entire family and access every service under AFDC. When you look at a family that has done that, when they're looking for one child's medical component, the cost to the state of Alaska increases by the entire size of that family. It is not cost effective to not implement options for those families that will not be eligible for waivers. I would like to point out that the waivered slots the state of Alaska has applied for are limited in the number, in that not all of the children we're talking about today will access a waivered slot. And in fact, some of those children do not need the additional services that are offered under waivered slots, but in fact just need the medical component to cover that child for medical coverage, which is inaccessible and unaffordable to most of us in the private sector due to pre-existing condition clauses and unaffordable insurance. These families cannot continue to be forced to separate or to live at the poverty level and have it be acceptable to this state, in my opinion. I would leave you with the question that my children ask me frequently is, why does my sister have to live with someone else? It's a very difficult question to explain to two other children why their sister must live in foster care when we want her at home.
Thanks, Chris. Thank you. Any questions of committee members? Okay, is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 5? Okay, if not, I'll conclude the public testimony. I know that there's an amendment that was distributed by Senator Ellis, and I have a couple of questions just on the bill generally. Just to help me understand it. Senator Ellis, could you go again through all of the ramifications of the difference between an option and a waiver?
Mr. Chairman, there may be someone here from the department. I see Jetta Whitaker in the audience who could give technical details, but generally I think of it as waivers, which we're applying for under Project Choice. If the department's operating budget requests are approved, that process will continue. And we're asking the federal government for waivers, which there will be a limited number of those. And under waivers, the department can offer to these families more services, respite care, and there's a whole list of them, supportive services, but they're limited in the number of people who can receive them. So there are, I believe, there are families, and reasonable people can disagree on this point, and that's why my bill is structured as sort of a backup. It only kicks in, if necessary, 180 days after the department has the waivers up and running. Whereas options that this bill is about offer less services, and Chris just gave the example that she just needs the medical component, what's available under EPSTAT, and there's a list here that can be provided. But everyone can qualify who's categorically eligible. So you usually see waivers and options together. I had a previous versions of this bill that the department thought, you know, last year we battled about it. They thought it was too expansive, and so we've compromised here a bit, and this just kicks in as a safety net. But options are fewer services, but more people can qualify, and that's what puts the families across the state more at ease. is that if the waiver doesn't fit them, and it's the department's call on this, if the department doesn't think that a waiver fits a child, then they would be able to offer the option, fewer services, so thereby cheaper, to the state of Alaska. But we're not going to, I'm convinced that under the waivers, not every family, we will still have families forced onto AFDC and forced into giving kids up. And, you know, one child kept in their home through supportive services and out of our Lady of Compassion nursing home to the tune of over $100,000 a year, you know, can provide a lot of these in-home services to other families and keep families together. I mean, marriages break up over this and on and on. You've heard the speech before, but the department could give a more technical answer about the difference between waivers and options, but that's
actually
an overview.
Okay, actually, we do have John Sherwood from the Division of Medical Assistance here. Could you come forward?
Sure.
I just want to really understand this, just so I can be part of those explaining the bills.
Well, a waiver...
could you state your name for the record?
Oh, okay. I'm John Sherwood with the Division of Medical Assistance. I'm a program coordinator at Project Choice. A waiver is just that. It's a waiver from the federal government from certain Medicaid restrictions, and it allows us to offer services we couldn't normally offer under our Medicaid program. And these waivers allow us to offer certain home and community-based services for individuals who otherwise would qualify for care in institutions. At the same time, we can use the same eligibility standards we use for people who would be in institutions. And that is how waivers expand the Medicaid eligibility. They apply the same income standard and resource standards we use for institutional clients to people on waivers. What this option does for children is it allows us to apply that same income standard to children in the community without a waiver from the federal government and without offering some additional services. There are some small technical differences between the two, that, but they're probably not really relevant for your purposes.
Okay, I know these sound like pretty technical questions, but I need to understand it. Back on page 3, if you have a copy of the bill, you have page 3, lines 4 and 5. Tell me what that means, where you say, to be individuals with respect to whom a supplemental security income is being paid.
Okay, you get... that means that these individuals would qualify for... they would be treated as if they qualified for supplemental security income, which is a federal program for the aged, the blind, and the disabled. And if you are eligible for supplemental security income, you are eligible for Medicaid. So that means we would treat you as if you were in a class of persons who's eligible for Medicaid. Most Medicaid eligibility is tied to your eligibility to another program, like AFDC or this one, SSI.
Does it mean they actually are being paid supplemental security income, or that they could be paid?
The way I read this, it means we would consider them to be in the class of people who could be paid SSI. It's kind of a roundabout way of stating they fit into the right class of people to be Medicaid eligible. It does not, it will not provide them an SSI payment.
Okay. On line 5 where it says is being, I guess I just wanted, why shouldn't that be could be paid? It might be a technical reason, but it tripped me up when I first read this.
It may be because the language says someone is supposed to receive an actual SSI payment and not just be eligible for SSI. We also have another eligibility clause that allows people under certain conditions who aren't receiving the payment to be treated as if they are receiving the payment. So it's, I will get back to, I'll look into that and see if there's some particular reason. I can't answer that right now.
Okay. I have one other question, then I hate to preempt the other committee members. The same page, lines 28 through 31, could you explain what that clause does?
Well, that is language which authorizes the department to offer services under a waiver that aren't listed in, I believe it's the previous section, section B of the service. And in that statute, if I'm remembering my statute correctly, that's the statute that lists the services we cover and we don't cover. And it says that we can offer services under a waiver even if they're not in the list.
Are there other questions of committee members? Senator Richard.
Thank you. I don't know if you're the right person to ask, but take a shot at it. A lot of the testimony says that there's children out there that are in institutions currently because the families at poverty level, and I assume the state's paying 50% Medicaid for that. Do you have any handle on how many there is? Would be eligible to, their option to come back into this program?
Well,
because I've heard testimony that apparently there is out there.
There are some children in institutions right now. It's difficult to say who would come out of institutions. I will check on the exact figures. My recollection is that there were 16 individuals in ICFMRs who were under 18, 9 individuals in nursing facilities, and there were many children in hospitals for some length of stay, but only about 5, I believe, in FY92 who were in for more than 100 days. We really can't tell for certain how many of those kids would be able to come out under an option or a waiver.
And so basically, the fiscal notes have no built-in allowances for any switches. These are gross figures you're talking about.
Right. With the case of ICFMR, there has not been an opening of any real length, an empty bed in Hope Cottages for a long time, and we think if we could put somebody into the community, that those beds would probably fill up. Mostly we'd probably be talking about kids coming out of hospitals, and there are actually very few kids at any given time who are in a hospital. This bill would certainly allow them to shorten their stay probably, but we made no estimate of savings.
Senator Ellis.
And Mr. Chairman, you know, the federal government forced us in the last year and a half to deinstitutionalize a number of people that could reasonably, for that to be done for them or to them. And as Chris Cullerton testified, that her child is in foster care because the federal government said, you can't keep these, it's inappropriate to have these people in this level of care and be expending this enormous amount of money just because, you know, legislatures haven't address this issue of deinstitutionalizing people that should be. So there are people that have come out of nursing homes, kids under the age of 18 that have gone to foster care. They're not with their families where they ought to be, and they're costing the state tremendous amounts of money, even when you can find a foster family that will take on that responsibility, which that's tough to do with just regular foster care parents. So it wouldn't just be people coming out of nursing homes or hospitals, but coming out of foster care back to their biological parents.
Other questions? I'd like to go back to this section 2. That seems to be not really germane to the main body of the bill, and I'd like to have a better explanation of why that's in there and what it does. Maybe I could ask the prime sponsor if he has any comment.
Mr. Chairman, this is one of those things that, you know, I've been working on this for 3 years, and I don't remember why it's originally in there, but my staff who's here, Diana Rhodes, can remind me why, if you'll allow the committee to hear from her.
Sure. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Diana Rhodes. I'm an aide to Senator Johnny Ellis. This language, I know it's kind of strange, and the bill drafter, Terry Lauterbach, needed this in there, and we've heard from the department, and they said, you know, you don't need that in there, and we didn't think it needed to be in there, but Terry Lauterbach says that they should not have, the department really didn't have the authority to apply, officially, to apply for the waivers, but they went ahead and did apply for the waivers anyway, because the you're supposed to have a law. A law is supposed to be passed directing the department to apply for any service that the legislature hasn't approved. But the legislature didn't pass a law. We passed a resolution,
Project Choice
resolution. So this is just kind of a technical way to clear up that the department may offer this service under a resolution rather than a law being passed. It's saying that the department can offer these services.
I understand the explanation for the applications for waivers that have occurred up to now. What I'm concerned about is how this fits in with the prioritization of medical assistance, for example, the type of thing which is listed on the next page. And it seems as though this language could bypass the prioritization process that the legislature goes through of saying what gets to the front of the line, what goes to the back of the line. It has nothing to do with, you know, the other material in this bill. I mean, this one is specifically treated in the law, but for example, I could see where we could pass a resolution next year asking the department to look into a waiver for some other thing, and maybe we inadvertently would put it ahead of the very service that we're providing for in this bill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the question's been posed to me. Why did I just have it drafted this way to put it number 20, you know, here at the bottom of the list, the first to go if funds are not appropriated for the full range of Medicaid services? And the practical part of my answer is that if you decide to prioritize here and put in, you make a whole bunch of enemies on the rest of this list for your legislation. And I'll just be honest with you and tell you that that's a consideration in trying to do something good with this bill. The second thing is that I understand the department's engaged in a fairly, it's a serious undertaking, but a fairly extensive undertaking of going through and trying to make sense of this list. And over the years, there have been additions and deletions and trying to see if there's another arrangement of this list that makes more sense. So there are things going on now to change the list around. I do understand your concern, and maybe we want to tighten up that language on page 3 to make it a little less, you know, expansive or loose, and I'd be happy to work with you on that. And the department, I don't know if they want to comment on the work they're doing now to make sense out of our Medicaid prioritization.
Senator Lehman?
I thought I had this, Mr. Chairman and Senator Ellis, figured out here on page 4. You said that it would be, and this list would be the first to go. It actually would be among some of the last to go. Says the department shall eliminate coverage in the following order. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah, no, you're right. It's the first group of people that are mentioned categorically, but these services, right.
Okay.
Yeah, it's always confusing because it works just the opposite way that you think it would work in terms of elimination of services. But it's the
first of the group of people.
I misspoke. Thank you very much.
Thanks. I understand.
Mr. Sherwood, do you have any comment on Section 2?
No, I don't. As Dennis stated, we'd taken the position in the past we did not need this in legislation, but I'm not an attorney and I'm not going to step in the middle of that.
Senator Salo.
Well, what's the potential harm of that section? I mean, whether you need it or not, to me, doesn't seem to be terribly germane to what we're going to do with this bill, but is there potential harm to that being in statute?
Well, I think that the potential harm, I understand, I agree with Senator Ellis, that it is a politically sensitive thing to try to tinker with the prioritizations that are listed on the next page. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure that means that we do any better by not having a look at new services as they're put in. And if I read Section 2 appropriately, our mere act of authorizing the department to investigate a future waiver, I mean, something we haven't even thought of today, bypasses that prioritization process. And I'm not sure that I'm willing to see the language be that open-ended. If we want to ratify retroactively the actions which occurred, we could make Section 2 refer to legislative resolutions which were passed prior to January 1st, 1993, so that we've covered what they've done to date. But it's much more open-ended by just saying that future resolutions bypass that prioritization list that has been in statute for years. Mr. Chairman,
my understanding is that number 19 on the priority list, long-term care non-institutional services, is where we see waivered services fitting in. And I think that that's where we see there's place on the priority list. If in the future we added another waivered service without some other action, it would be treated as part of that. Those services would be treated as part of that.
Well, wouldn't that be true only if we asked you to look into some form of long-term care non-institutional service for the waiver? I mean, what if we came up with something totally different?
That's possible. I mean, most of these kinds of waivers address long-term care services. So.
Okay. Yeah, these do.
So
Senator Ellis.
Through the chair to Mr. Sherwood, do you disagree with Ms. Lauterbach's analysis that we need to fix it, to legitimize in statute what was done under Project Choice? I mean, do you reject that outright? And
I won't venture an opinion on that. Obviously my department has pursued waivers on the basis of a resolution.
Yeah.
And also, I would say there is this reference in statute to non-institutional long-term care services, which we have always understood to include waiver services if we offered a waiver.
I know we closed the public testimony, but I got a message over the line that Laura Putnam would like to speak again. If you're still there, why don't you go ahead?
Okay, and maybe I can clarify this a little bit and help you understand the difference between a waiver and an option. In order for a waiver to take effect, or the State of Alaska's Division of Medical Assistance, John, correct me if I'm wrong on this, has the right to apply for a waiver without having an enactment of law. In order for the option to occur, the legislature has to enact a law, and at that time, then the State of Alaska Division of Medical Assistance can check the appropriate box that allows a waiver, an option to go into effect. Is that correct?
Mr. Sherwin?
And that's why Section 2 needs to be included in this bill, giving the Division of Medical Assistance the legal right to go forth.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to venture an opinion. Again, this is out of my league here.
Ms. Putnam?
Yes.
Would you be, with respect to this bill, would there be, I don't know if you have a copy of the bill in front of you, I hope you do. Would it cover your concern if on line 31 at the end, after the word legislature, the words were added prior to January 1st, 1993, so that we've covered what has occurred up to date, waivers applied to date? Or options applied to date, I guess is the right phrase.
Has not applied for an option yet. They need to have the approval of the legislature to do that. The Division of Medical Assistance needs to be given the instructions, if you will, to do so. And it takes an act of legislature to do that. And so that's what this bill is requesting, that the State of Alaska Division of Medical Assistance apply for options. In order for them to do that, I don't recall what page number it is on their Medicaid and federal government forms, but it requires the checking of a box, and that starts the application process for options.
Mr. Chair, again, to try and clear up a confusion, Section 2 refers to offering services. This option we're talking about is not a service option. It's an eligibility option.
Correct.
Under the option, we would not be offering any people additional services. So therefore, the language shouldn't apply to the option in this bill.
Okay, why don't we, Elmer. You know, yeah, Elmer Lindstrom's here, and I'm going to ask my staff to try to get Terry Lauterbach on the phone or over here. Mr. Lindstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Elmer Lindstrom. I'm a special assistant to Commissioner Mala in the Department of Health and Social Services. A number of questions have been raised, some of which I do not know the answer to. However, I do know that the position of the department and the administration remains that we do not need specific statutory authority to enter into waivers under the Medicaid program. We've gone forward with the waivers. They've been approved. Four of them have been approved by the federal government and will be implemented beginning July 1 of 1993. I'm not aware of any problems that would arise by having this language in the bill, but I wouldn't want the committee to think that the administration would feel precluded from going forward in the future with waiver applications, not having having authority to do so in statute.
Other questions? I think while we're waiting for see if we can get Terry Lauterbach either in person or on the phone over here, why don't we deal with Senator Ellis's amendment? Senator Ellis.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, this is page 3, line 25. After the word "are," deleting the rest of that and inserting either not available to them or are inappropriate for them under this chapter. That just makes the point that waivers that they're currently applying for under Project Choice are not appropriate for all families, and it would remain the call of the department of what, in consultation with the family, you would hope of what is appropriate, if the option is appropriate. So I would move this as amendment number 1.
I'll object for discussion purposes. Could you give me an example of how this would play out and why the amendment's necessary?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I couldn't give you an example, but there. I was thinking of respite services, but I can't think of any family that doesn't benefit from respite services, which is available under a waiver, not available under an option. But there may be someone online, Mr. Chairman, who can give a real life experience of a service that a service under a waiver that's inappropriate for that family. So what you're talking about there is if you can serve a family through an option that's potentially less expensive than a waiver because it's a lesser range of services, why fill up the limited number of waiver slots with that family? Give an option to the family that needs less services so the family that has a more complex child that has a need for a greater range of services can take up the limited waiver slot. That's kind of the practical import here. But in terms of a specific service, I would ask if it's appropriate, Mr. Chairman, anyone who's had a real-life family experience that could give an example.
Senator Sharp, before we go.
Just, is this the amendment referred to in a fiscal note? That was.
Mr. Chairman, I've been told the fiscal note just changed recently, and so yeah, I'm not sure. But I think the department will be in support of this amendment. It makes things more clear for them. But
okay. Let's see. I'm trying to think of where to go first. Mr. Sherwood first. I know there's someone in the audience who wants to testify on amendment number 1. Mr. Sherwood.
Regarding the amendment, that that section D there on page 3. Under a waiver, we do not the we do not, the federal government does not waive the requirement that we offer any option to someone. So if this option is on the books, they would get that option regardless of whether they were, or whether a waiver was available to them. So, so we have never really considered that that language to have much effect. We do not waive the right, the client's right to get optional, to be covered under an optional group when they give us a waiver. So if you enact this option, people are entitled to it whether there is a waiver space available or not, if they qualify. Am I making myself clear there? The option comes first, always. They get the option first, and then you can address the issue. They can make the choice of whether they want the waiver.
Because the waiver's more.
The waiver's more, that's right.
So, okay.
Why don't you hold for a second? Please come forward again. State your name again, and I think you have an example for us.
Christine Culleton, yes, I do. A lot of families access services through the public school system and do not need duplicated services through Health and Human Services other than the medical component. And that would be a perfect example of someone who would just need an option, in that the school district provides OT, PT, speech, and other related support services under special education. They currently have the infant learning program in this state, which is underfunded, but that's another issue. But at age three, they do go into the public school system. So some families truly just do need the medical component and not the other services that are offered under a waiver, in that an optional service would give them the Medicaid coverage for the medical condition, and many school districts contribute a goodly portion of support services through the district program that these families wouldn't need to access through a waiver. They would be duplicated services that would be deemed unnecessary, and I'm sure ineligible under Medicaid criteria if it was deemed that that whatever school district the child resided in was liable to provide that service.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Sherwood, your testimony here, maybe, I don't know, this might be Mr. Lindstrom, but your testimony is that the fiscal note's unchanged with or without, because you're going to offer this option regardless of the availability of waiver slots?
With or without the amendment, I don't see, yes, my testimony is that would not lead me to change the fiscal note on this bill. I think the client would still have the right to the optional service, whether that additional language was added or not, or the optional coverage, excuse me.
Okay. Any other discussion on amendment number one? Okay, is there any objection to amendment number one? Okay, hearing none, amendment number one is adopted. Terry Lauterbach is on her way over. I don't know if there's any other amendments that will be offered on the bill. If not, we can just hang on. We'll take a 2 or 3 minute recess while she comes from across the street. I'd call a meeting of Senate Hess back to order. We have Terry Lauterbach with us, who is with our legislative division of legal services. Lauterbach, the question, and I guess I raised it, was on page 3, lines 28 through 31. There is several parts, but the question first is why it's in there, and secondly, what the effect of that language would be on future legislative requests for the department to investigate waivers or options, I guess, waivers or options, and would this language allow such a waiver or option to take some kind of precedence ahead of other things that are in the optional services list? Several parts. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, let's start with, are we on teleconference?
Yes, we are.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I'm Terry Lauterbach, for the record, from the Division of Legal Services. Section 2 of SSSB 5, as I understand it, ratifies a past practice that Hess has already been doing. They've been applying for waivers from the federal government to offer services allowed under federal waivers, and offering those services even though they haven't been authorized by the legislature. The statute that's amended by Section 2 says that the department has to offer things that are mandatory under federal law. And it says, in addition, the department may offer only the following optional services, and the legislature has laid out what those optional services are. The new subsection C that I've added here would sort of ratify what the department's already been doing and let them continue to do it in the future, to apply for waivers from the federal government to offer other services, even though they're not listed in subsection B. What that would do to the priority listing is nothing, because those services would not be listed in the priority listing. And I'm not sure how the department's been treating the past optional services they've gotten under waivers when it comes to lack of funding. I don't know what they've been doing with those in the past. But the statute's clear to me that the department may offer only the following services. So in order to offer something that the federal government allows under a waiver, it seems to me you need a statute to authorize the department to do that. That's why Section 2 is in the bill.
Okay, there was a distinction. Is there a distinction between an option and a waiver as far as how this language affects what's going on? Or is this only speaking to waivers but not
this to particular section, Mr. Chairman, is only speaking to waivers.
Okay.
Section 1 of the bill picks up a federal option to cover a group. See, you have to distinguish between groups of people that are covered for all services and optional services that already authorized groups will get. Section 1 does pick up what's called an optional group, the persons who are could be institutionalized but aren't. So that's an optional group, but we're amending the law to do that. If the department only tried to do that under a waiver, they'd also run into trouble, because that section that's about groups says additional groups may not be added unless approved by the legislature. I don't know if the department's been doing that without authorization too, or only services. If they've also been adding groups without specific amendment of the statute, then maybe we should be amending 4707.020 also to authorize what they've been doing under federal options and waivers as to groups.
Can I give you a hypothetical?
Sure.
Let's say that next year the legislature authorized the department to pursue another waiver in whatever way they did it, it qualified under the Section 2.
For a group or a service?
Service. Okay. And the department pursues it and then commences offering that service. And then follow it through. Let's say money is tight and not all the services can be provided that are listed on the optional list of priority medical assistance, let's say. Would the law require the department to follow 4707.035 about how they reduce those in that order, and so that the optional service that the department has started to offer as a waiver, or the waivered service that the department started to offer, in effect is the last to go, because the statute says that these have to go first in the following order?
I think so, Mr. Chairman. We could, of course, okay, amend Section 2 to achieve a different result and make an option a waivered service be first to go. You could certainly amend Section 2 to take care of that. But the way Section 2 is now, I think they'd have to follow the listing in 035 and take things off that way, effectively leaving the waivered service fully funded. But that's fixable if you want to change it.
Can I ask you another question? What difference would the bill have as far as what we're trying to accomplish, if the words prior to January 1st, 1993 were added to this Section 2? In other words, this notwithstanding only applies to waivers which were authorized by concurrent or joint resolution prior to January 1st, 1993.
If you did not have a strict understanding with the department that they couldn't do it in the future, I would expect them to keep doing what they've done in the past. You'd be ratifying what they'd done up till now, but I don't know for sure you'd be stopping what they might continue to do. You may have to ask the department about that. You certainly could put a cutoff date on this, and I'd probably move it to temporary law if you did, but that's a drafting matter. But you could ratify their past additions of services. You may want to find out specifically what those are, though, in order to add them to the priority listing. And then we could add them to the priority listing.
Well, I guess my concern is really the first question, that the way it reads, anything that gets offered as a waivered service under Section 2 ends up being automatically top priority. And we've maybe accomplished something we really never intended to accomplish. Because we're not talking about these services. We're talking about something we haven't even thought about today, or at least is not at issue today.
Well, Mr. Chairman, maybe we could hear from the department what falls under waivered services, because most of them are things that I think most of us would agree are more important to these families than some of the other things on the list. Like I said, the department has an effort underway, I believe, if I'm informed correctly, that to try and make more sense out of this list and make a proposal to the legislature in the future. But I don't know, maybe that would clear up some of the confusion if we heard a description of what waivered services are.
Are we going to hear a description of what all future waivered services are, too, so that they can express an opinion that all the future waivered services are at the top of the list, too?
Well, I would submit that, well, you never know with the administration what they might come up with. Maybe you have a good point with this administration.
Well, I don't think it has anything to do with the administration. The fact is that we're trying to determine whether we want to automatically give top priority to all future waivered services when we don't today even know what those are and how they stack up with respect, including, I might point out, the way this reads, that they would be ahead of the service which this bill puts into the list. I mean, you're taking something unknown and essentially moving this bill down the list by whatever gets put in another way.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not making a judgment about what we want to do here, as opposed to it might help the committee's understanding to know what waivered services are contemplated currently under Project Choice. That was my only point.
Okay, that's fair. Okay. Terry.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just clarify again, this bill, this section of the bill isn't what's causing the waivered services to take precedence. That's already happened. This bill is just ratifying something that's already happening. It's not giving them some new authority.
Senator Salem.
Well, let me try to phrase the question. How, though, could we change Section 2 of the bill to protect from what Chairman Rieger is seeing as the potential for future wide-open waivers and where they might fall on the list?
Through the chair, you could amend that section to require legislation to be submitted the following year, putting it somewhere on the options list. Right now, I'm not sure that enough communication is going on to know what kind of waivered services are being sought by the department and whether the legislature even knows what those are. At least you could put in a mechanism that would require legislation to be brought forward.
Okay.
Senator Salem.
The only other option would be to empower the department with the authority to sort of properly place the waiver service on that priority list. I mean, that's sort of, I guess, implied by the absence of any language as it is. But it seems to me that her first suggestion about legislation dealing with it would be a solution.
I'm just trying to see if we can fix this problem. Would it work on Section 3 in the next page to somewhere there make reference to the waivered services? Is that the nature of your suggestion?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, you could add a general reference to any service offered by the department under a waiver from the federal government that they were not directed to get by the legislature, and put that number one. If they're directed to get it by the legislature ahead of time, I would guess that bill or resolution would say where on the priority list they want it to be once the waiver's approved. But if you want to take care of past services that they've already done, you could make a general reference and make it number one on the list, so that any waivered service would go before the listed ones.
The problem is, I'm not sure I want to do that either.
Yeah.
I just want to have a chance to see where it fits on the list is all.
Yeah.
Well, might I suggest we find out what waivered services there are and deal with it when we have some specifics,
sure.
At least as to past ones.
Sure.
It's maybe a little different issue with the future ones, and maybe your January cutoff date would be dealing with the future.
I see Elmer Lindstrom anxious to come to the table. Elmer, do you have any comment on this?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, again, Elmer Lindstrom from the Department of Health and Social Services. I believe these are the only, the project choice waivers that we've been discussing are the only waivers that the department has ever sought or contemplates seeking at this point. If it would be, and again to reiterate our position that the section under discussion is not necessary in the belief of the department and the administration, we would be happy to have the Department of Law come down and speak to that question under what legal authority we went forward with the existing waivers, and I'm sure they would do that with some advance notice. I think the concern of the committee of future waivers and where they would fall on the list is a theoretical problem, but not a real one. The project choice waivers have been something that have been discussed for 5 or 6 years. There are not any stealth waivers out there, and I don't think it would be possible or conceivable for this administration or any administration to go forward with a waiver without being in close contact with the legislature and seeking their advice on that matter.
It's not my suggestion that it's a stealth waiver, but rather any waiver. Even if we knew fully well exactly what was being applied for, it's just a mechanism for getting it into its proper place on the priority list.
Mr. Chairman, again, I guess my thought would be that there are waivers and there are waivers. There might be some waivers that the legislature and the department would consider of one level of priority and other waivers that would be of a different level of priority. So I'm not certain that by having the word waivers somewhere on the priority list that you are going to be satisfied ultimately.
Yeah. Okay, well, I think I have an amendment I'm going to offer because I think it started kind of clear. Especially since we have the legal drafters here. On section 2, we added a sentence which said, after legislature, at the end of that, add a sentence, the department shall submit to the legislature its recommendations for placement of any service offered under this subsection onto the priority list, onto the priority list 4707035.
One more time, Mr. Chairman.
Well, it's kind of poorly worded. I'll restate it a little differently. The department shall submit to the legislature its recommendations for placement onto the priority list, parentheses 4707035, close parentheses, of any service offered under this subsection. Which would then, maybe we should say annually, but then it would allow the department to proceed, but before much time goes by, the department would give its recommendation to the legislature, and the legislature would have a chance to look at where it should fit into the priority order. Do you have any slider back in?
Well, I assume you'd give me a little drafter's license with that if it came over the board.
Yeah.
Of course.
Conceptual amendment.
Okay. Does it make sense? Does it address the problem?
Except for the fact that you don't put a time deadline on the department to do that, it does. It probably should be to the first regular session of the legislature that meets after the waiver is approved.
Well, I didn't go farther. I suppose that until the legislature acts and puts it on the list, the department should submit its recommendation each year until we do it. Why don't we just say the department shall annually submit to the legislature its recommendations?
And would your understanding be that in the meantime, it would be the last service to go? Mm-hmm. Since it's not on the list anywhere, it would always be fully funded. Is that your understanding? That as long as it's not on the placement list, it'll never be cut off?
I guess that's my understanding because that's the way the bill reads. Mm-hmm. I'm not entirely happy with it, but haven't been able to come up with a better solution. Well, I'll offer that as amendment number 2.
Chair?
Yeah.
If I could just say one thing.
This is John Sherwood. the department has always believed that waivered services qualify under 19 in the priority list, long-term care, non-institutional services. To the best of my knowledge, there are no other services that fit into that category that we offer besides at this time. And that's how we have always interpreted that language. And that's where we assumed was the appropriate place for any long-term care services that were offered under home and community-based service waivers.
Put it there, unless.
Okay. Well, that means that next year you wouldn't be submitting a recommendation because your department's position is that it's covered under one of the priorities. Does everyone understand amendment number two?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't have a problem with amendment number two. Is it necessary to express our intent in some fashion or our agreement with the department about that interpretation of number 19, that that's where waivers fit in? I don't know if it's important to establish that in the record or not, but...
I don't have a...
I have no objection to amendment number two.
Senator Sayre.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, actually... I like amendment number two, and I think that even though the department has been categorizing those waivered services under number 19 on that priority list, that regardless of how they fit them in, it might be good for that report to come to the legislature, whether it's in an existing category on there or inserted at the top of the list, the bottom of the list, or wherever. So I don't see that as being a problem with the amendment language that you proposed.
Is there any other any objection to amendment number two? I'll give my handwritten copy to Terry Lauterbach to use her graphics license on. Are there any other amendments to Senate Bill 5? Is there any other committee debate on Senate Bill 5? What's the will of the committee? Senator Miller.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill, or sponsor substitute for Senate Bill 5 with the amendments and accompanying fiscal notes out of committee with individual recommendations.
Any objection? Hearing none, bill's moved. I'd like to announce to the committee members that try to clean up whatever other pressing legislation is before us next week and start taking up the bills dealing with health care the week after next. So I know that some of you had asked for some advance notice for people that you might want to be contacting. Testimony. Senator Zala?
Yes. I don't know if we need to be on a teleconference here.
That's
now.
Right. That's right.
But so my concern after the discussion we had on the floor this morning is the one health care bill that is fairly substantial didn't come to this committee. Senate Bill 40, the one we were dealing with today. Will that be part of the mix? Because I know there's going to be a sponsor switch on it. And so are we going to have that bill along with the other health care issues or not?
I suppose it's up to the President of the Senate and where the bills get referred. But the bill, my understanding is that Senate Bill 40, or almost a nearly verbatim copy of it, passed the Senate last year and almost passed through the House. It was... held up for whatever reasons I can't comment to. I wasn't here. But there's a lot of interest in that bill, a lot of desire to see the bill passed. You and I both serve on Labor and Commerce, and there was unanimous testimony in favor of it. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't seem to be the kind of bill that is looking for a lot of committee work. It's one that we should just get through and get out there so that people who are employed by small employers have a better chance of receiving health insurance.
Okay, I mean, the two comments in return on that is, one is, even though it had, you're right, everybody testified in favor of it, but there were a lot of amendments, some technical and some a little bit more substantive, that were sort of left hanging at the end of the Labor and Commerce hearing that we had the other day. And then the other comment is, I don't at least have a picture of a good picture of how that fits into the overall issue of healthcare reform. If it's going to move along separately, I mean, I'm supportive of the bill. I just wanted to know how it's going to be dealt with here.
I can't. Bill wasn't referred to this committee.
Okay.
It, I don't expect it to be dealt with here, but it's you know, I think that there's plenty of work for us to do on the areas which are not covered in the bill, which haven't been reviewed before by the legislature. I mean, there's a lot of work, and so I think that we're going to have our hands full as it is. Senator Duncan?
Chairman, could we have a next day or so a specific date as to when, for example, the bill that encompasses recommendations from the task force, Senate Bill 114, will be heard in committee? There are some folks that we would like to try to get here, but we're going to need a little bit of notice as to the date that hearing is going to be. And maybe something more specific would be helpful, because it's my hope we can get the consultant that we had working with the task force to come and testify on the recommendations that are encompassed in that bill.
Senator Duncan, I would be glad to do all I can to accommodate whatever lead time you need, and I'll have my staff work with your staff. The reason I brought it up today, even though it wouldn't be calendared for next week, was to give you some advance notice, but right. I think that's the best way to approach it would be to try to give you the specific date that you can count on, or dates, plural, that you can count on for us hearing that bill,
okay.
For your bill. And there's other bills also in the hopper.
Yeah.
We try to do everything we can to make sure that it all coordinates so that you can have the advance notice. And I think it was either your office or Senator Ellis's that asked for advance notice, just so that we could get out of town people here.
Yeah, and we have one individual who may come from the East Coast, so we need to have quite a bit of advance notice if we can. I mean, you know, there's much,
you know,
you know, what, 2 weeks and a half or whatever you got to do,
okay.
You'll be fine.
Great.
Try to get the individual here.
Be glad to do that. If there's any other no other business to come before, I guess we're adjourned.